All right, this is a really cool and interesting conversation I have coming up with the Deputy Commissioner of the NBA, Mark Tatum. So Harvard Business School has a student-run organization that is the Business of Sports and Entertainment Club. They hosted us for this panel, and I appreciate them for calling me and having me moderate this keynote conversation. I asked Mark some tough questions. Hopefully he still likes me afterwards, but you be the judge.
This is the Dominique Foxworth Show.
Thank you all for being here. And I think I wanted to start with the concept, at least the way that I view it. We're talking about sports. Sports is art, and art becomes entertainment, and entertainment has value. And there's always a challenge, I think, of balancing the value of entertainment and maintaining the soul of the art. And you see that with music, movies, acting, and all that stuff. How do you think the NBA does that job right now?
Yeah, I think it starts with the game. It all starts with the game. It all starts with the best athletes in the world. Our players are just incredible athletes. They do superhuman things in a graceful way. And so for us, it is about the beauty of the game, the teamwork that is required to move the ball and to put that round ball in that hoop. And it's a game that's played all over the world. And I think one of the things that over time, from the beginning of the NBA, and certainly the most recent history, is the personality of the players, right? There's no sport where you actually can have your feet as a spectator on the field of play. And so that accessibility and that proximity to the players who are playing in shorts and are, you know, 6'7", 7 feet, and being able to be right there on the court with them, it's an incredible experience. And so it is about the authenticity. It's about the energy of the game. It's about the globality of the game. I think today with 125 players in our league, nearly 30% of our league, there's a different style that's come to our game. So I think all those things contribute to making the game a fun, entertaining experience.
You've tapped into some of my insecurities as a football player versus basketball player in that the celebrity of the players there is of huge value. And I think there's some drawback to that. I think the perception of the NBA right now is that the off-court behavior and transaction, and I don't mean behavior in a negative way, but those guys are celebrities. And what they're doing, the following that they have on social media, football players are not even comparable, but the popularity, at least in the United States, of football compared to basketball is also not comparable in the other direction. How do you guys figure out how to optimize the profitability of those guys' images?
Yeah, it's incredible. Our NBA players have the biggest social media platforms in the world. When you look at the top players in the world and their social media following, there's a few football, meaning soccer players, and there's NBA players, and they've got these global followings. And I would say one of the things that has evolved over time, first of all, our players are of that demographic, they're of that age. And so many of the new technologies that we learn about, we learn from our players because they're early adapters. They're the ones that are experiencing and experimenting with these new technologies before it becomes mainstream. And we learn from that. The other thing I would say that has really evolved over time is that players now at a much younger age are aware of the opportunities to build their brands, their personal brands in junior high school, in high school, with the advent of platforms like Overtime and being able to be broadcast to a global audience. By the time these young men and women come into professional basketball or college basketball, they're already known entities and known brands.
And I think that speaks directly to the challenge that I was trying to present to you, is that there is an idea that the players want to be brands and the league wants to brand itself in a way that is marketable. And there's some of that that conflicts, I think, with what we started at, with the art of the game and the soul of the game. And I think we find in modern basketball, at least, there has been a depreciation, at least from the fans' perspective, of the regular season versus the postseason. That's something that you guys are aware of, and how do you plan to address it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is the in-season tournament was an example of where we took these games that were really the beginning of our season, heavy competition period against the start of the NFL season in college football. And what we realized over time, it is a long regular season. And in general, American sports is a long regular season, and then you have this playoffs. Because we're such a global sport, we learn from other international leagues and what other international leagues do. And what we realize is that in things like soccer globally, they compete for multiple cups and championships. You know, I know that we're doing this PSG case after this, and just in France alone, there's three cups that they compete for. And then there's a European championships as well. In the NBA, it's a long season. And at the end of the day, there's one winner and there's 29 teams that feel like it was a waste of a season. And so what we want to do is take those games and create another opportunity to win something for the fans, for the players. So it gave some additional meaning to those early season games. And I will tell you, viewership was up double digits. We set a record for attendance in the month of November, which is going to lead us to probably set an all-time attendance record for the year. So fans were so into it because it created a set of regular season games and made them more meaningful.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy the in-season tournament. I'm old, so the courts offended me, but the basketball.
But when you tuned in, you knew.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I recognized the point of having the courts, and I thought that it made sense, and some 16-year-olds probably thought it was awesome, but it made my head hurt. But the games were incredibly fun.
That is one of the things we are going to adapt.
No, you got to iterate. That's something exactly. That we understand. You grow and you learn. But I think that seems to be an obvious success. But you mentioned the globalization of the game and how that impacts the way that you want to present an in-season tournament. I recognize in world football how that works. But there's another model also for how to make the regular season more intense and more exciting. And that's like the American sports model. And the cream of the crop in American sports is American football. And it's fewer games. So the idea of reducing the number of games as opposed to inserting more intense games in the in-season tournament, how do you guys think about that? And this, I think, goes back to the first premise of this, is balancing the art of the game versus profit maximization.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. It's obviously something that we've looked at, we've studied. And I would say that, you know, it's one of those things right now where when you look, first of all, when you look at the attendance, we continue to set attendance records. People have shown that they are willing to come out and go to 41 home games. But you're right, we're always looking at ways to create more value around those games. And, you know, and these things like these cups might be an opportunity for us to do more of those, to break the season down into more competitions within a competition. And I think if we can do that, that gives you a little bit more flexibility so you're not sacrificing the business, because, you know, obviously there is a business that's associated with playing 41 games for our broadcast partners, for ticket sales, for merchandise. And so it's balancing all those different interests.
You bring up the broadcast partners, and domestic media rights have kind of been the lifeblood for American sports up until this point, and we don't expect that to change, but the media landscape is definitely changing a lot from pay TV to streaming. And we see the RSNs is a big deal for sports like basketball and baseball, and that market itself is not as strong as it once was. So I think as you guys approach a new domestic media rights deal, so I think it's probably a two-part question. First, how do you address the domestic media rights deal? And given how globalized your game is, I think of the first team All-NBA team last year, Jason Tatum.
I wasn't for All-NBA.
Yeah, you can't.
In the league office I was, but not on the
court. I think he was the only American-born player on that team. So yeah, could you talk to me about what your plans are for maximizing the opportunity for domestic and international media rights?
Yeah, I'll say a couple of things. One is we are actually approaching it as a global negotiation. So yes, the vast majority of our revenue comes from the domestic partners, in our case, Warner Brothers Discovery and Disney. However, what we did is we actually lined up all of our international media deals to expire coterminous with the expiration of the US deals. And so that gives us the opportunity to really go out and provide a global offering to a particular company that's interested in global rights. So we're really approaching this as a global media rights negotiation. That being said, our incumbents are Disney and Warner Brothers Discovery. They've been fantastic partners of ours. We're in the middle. We've got the rest of the season and one more season to go on that deal, but we're in the middle of an exclusive negotiating window now. We've been meeting with our incumbents for months, and they've expressed an interest in renewing. And we are hopeful that we're going to continue our partnership with them. I will say this, given the evolving media landscape, I think that we're likely to emerge from this window with at least one additional partner. And as we think about our approach to this, it really is about accessibility. Because of the changing landscape in media, consumers, fans are watching content and consuming content in a variety of different ways, through traditional TV and cable, through streaming and digital. So we need to make sure that as a sports property, we are delivering that content and delivering games wherever those fans are. So accessibility is a big part of what we're trying to do here. Discoverability is a big part of what we're trying to do. Right now, if you're an NBA fan, it can be really difficult to find where your games are. We need to, in this new partnerships going forward, make it really easy for fans to be able to say, where can I get the game tonight? One-stop shopping. And then the last thing, which is a priority for us, is the personalization and the customization of the experience for fans, because we know that fans, certain fans, want to see games in a different way. They may be more interested in stats. They may just want the game presented as it's always been presented. Mm-hmm. They may want commentary. They may want it in a different language, different camera angles. So we are investing in all of that now to personalize the experience. And you can do that through streaming and digital, where you can have multiple streams. And we're already doing that on our League Pass product.
Yeah, the most important thing I think you would say in any business is that the product is good and strong, and your product is strong, but there are some challenges. And I think the biggest one that pops into my mind is the intensity of the games. And we had the big story around the All-Star game, where it was obviously not an ideal exertion of effort from the players, which, like, I get. And that's, again, it's about the dual motives, I guess, of the league and the players. It's to win a championship, and the league, it's to create a great product. And you can't win a championship on All-Star weekend. And that aside, you can't win a championship in, I don't know, a game 65 of the regular season. So how do you address the players' intensity in the regular season?
Yeah, I think for us, it's about the competitiveness of the games. And I would say we like where the game is right now from a competition standpoint. You know, everyone talks about the high scoring, but I will tell you, we're not focused on the high scoring. We're focused on, are the games competitive? And by all the metrics that we look at, they are competitive. And by the way, the other thing that I think has really helped with the intensity of the games that we implemented in addition to the in-season tournament was the play-in tournament. So now, you know, just as an example, last year, with a week left to go in the season, 25 of our 30 teams still had a chance to make it into the play-in. And you saw last year the Miami Heat, a play-in team, make a run all the way to the finals. And so right now, what you're seeing is more intensity after the All-Star game because teams are jockeying for position. Top four gives you home court advantage. Top six guarantees you a playoff spot. And then 7 through 10 gets you in the play-in for an opportunity to play into the playoffs. So that has really ratcheted up now. Like, I've been watching games every night, and the competition, the competitiveness of those games now is really at a high level. So that's really what we're focused on.
The Heat is a perfect example, I think, of what I was trying to illustrate, and it seems to some degree you're not willing to accept, is that the regular season and the postseason is different. The Heat were a play-in team in part because Jimmy Butler, the best player on their team, kind of telegraphs to the entire league that, you know what, it ain't time yet. It's not time to be intense until it's time to be intense.
Yeah, I don't subscribe to that. They had a bunch of injuries, and I think those things play into it as well. I mean, you look at Boston right now. Boston is locked in, and they've been locked in for a while. You look at those teams in the West between Minnesota, OKC, Denver, they are locked in. Like, they're not cruising, and I think because of the playoff structure, I mean, you look at every night, there's a different team in first place in the West. Every night, they're, like, going back and forth. And again, it's because those teams want to finish in the top four. They don't want to slip to 5-6. Houston now is coming up on Golden State and the Lakers, so they need to be conscious of that. So, you know, I don't think that teams are cruising through the regular season in the way that they perhaps may have in the past.
I'll accept that you're right, and I'll leave it at this one question. Is, I think you would agree, whether it's true or false, you would agree that there is a perception that exists. So then how do you address the perception if you believe that the games are at a very intense and competitive level?
Yeah, no doubt. There is that perception. I think part of the perception is the scoring and the increased scoring. But I think the things like the in-season tournament, things like the play-in, those sorts of things are helping. And we continue to look at, with the competition committee, we always look at our rules. We very rarely, if ever, make mid-season rules changes, but it's something that we are discussing now, to look at the offensive versus defensive balance, to make sure that that's in sync and that the games are competitive. That's what we're really focused on.
You said very rarely, if ever, make in-season rule changes. Was there an in-season rule change this year? I think number of fouls after the All-Star game. There was a number of things that changed about the games. And I think most people agree that the games got better, but the scoring went down. We felt like 50 and 60, 70 point scorers almost every night before the All-Star game, it felt like. And that certainly has changed after the All-Star break. Was there a rule change in the NBA in season?
No, there wasn't. Again, that might have been a natural, you know, okay, after the All-Star game now, you start looking at locking in March, and I think that probably, you know, has something to do with it. But there were no in-season rules changes that were implemented.
All right, there's a couple of sticky topics I think that we certainly need to address going forward, one being the decision by the league to allow up to 5% of sovereign wealth funds to invest in teams. And we understand, and again, it goes back to profit maximization against like what we originally view this game as. And we see in the world's football that there are some growing pains when it comes to becoming a business from being a league, or at least blending the business aspects of being a league. So right now, I think Qatar is and I live in D.C., so Washington, it was big news when Washington sold off some of their team to the Qatari Wealth Fund. The question is, what do you guys do when what happened with LIV Golf, or when the Saudi Wealth Fund is looking to invest in American basketball teams?
Yeah, so I would say a couple of things. One is 2 years ago in 2022, the Board of Governors allowed for institutional investors, so not just sovereign wealth funds, but pension funds and other institutional investors to invest in NBA franchises. And one of the reasons that the board decided to do that and the league decided to do that is because when you look at the growth of franchise values in the NBA, they've grown significantly over time. And today the average NBA franchise is worth $4 billion. You know, and quite frankly, there are fewer and fewer people in the world that can write a check for an equity for that amount of money. And we have debt rules and how much you can take out to use to purchase the team. So what institutional investors do is it opens up an entire new pool of capital. And this pool of capital views sports franchises as a very solid investment, because a lot of times sports leagues and teams are counter to the market. You know, people actually say, 15 years from now, will we all be using iPhones? I don't know. I mean, when I remember, I'm old enough, you're old enough to remember we were using Blackberries. So 15 years ago, do you know that the iPhone is going to be the device of choice? We don't know. But it's a good bet that the Boston Celtics are going to be here, right? So our approach on institutional investors is it's an additional source of capital. It provides optionality and flexibility for teams. And the difference between, I'd say, what a LIV Golf is and what we're doing is that these investments are minority investments. They're passive, non-controlling investments. So you don't have a situation like in international soccer or football where you've got primary ownership by sovereign wealth funds, and we don't have that situation.
Yeah, that's what the future holds, and I'm not going to push you down a slippery slope conversation. I don't think that's probably fruitful, but I do think that there should be some concern with the profit maximization. So the point of, like you mentioned, bringing in sovereign wealth funds and bringing in institutional investors is because of franchise valuations. And few people can pay what a franchise value actually is in order to keep growing the franchise valuations. But if you are going to open yourself up to organizations and people who expect consistent returns, I think that that's going to change the way that the businesses are run. And this goes back to the original conversation, is that feels a lot more soulless and more business oriented when it's like, all right, this is an institutional fund. This is the returns that we expect. It's different from the personality of the game that I think you and I grew up watching, where there were owners who owned the team were a little bit wacky. There were some players who were a little bit wacky. All this professionalization of sports and sports ownership does, to me at least, impact the character of the game.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't necessarily subscribe to that. I think what the capital that's being invested into our teams are doing, it's providing for the opportunity to build better experiences for fans. It allows us to build direct-to-consumer platforms, allows us to build these incredible facilities for our players, for our fans, for the experiences. And quite frankly, it allows us to expand globally on a global basis. You know, that's a big part of what we're doing. And I think a big part of our strategic opportunity and advantage here is that you know, there's only 5% of the world that's in the United States, but that means 95%+ of the world is outside the United States, and they love basketball.
Right.
And places where there's a billion people or more, like China, like Africa, right? Those investments, because it's not just about driving franchise valuation for its sake. It's about investing in the business of basketball to grow the game of basketball. And I think every sports league is in the business of growing their sport, growing their business. And that additional source of capital allows us to invest in those kinds of experiences for the fans and to make it more accessible and to grow the game.
Now, let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured. It was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Barnstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Swimsuit, check. Sunscreen, check. Phone charger, check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or in a carry-on. And the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hi, this is ESPN's Mike Greenberg, and ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sports book of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today, and new users get $100 in bonus bets for making any sportsbook bet. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your favorite sports podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music, included with your Prime membership. Amazon Music offers the most ad-free top podcasts. Enjoy shows like First Take, Pardon the Interruption, and The Low Post, available ad-free and uninterrupted. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or go to amazon.com/ESPN pods. That's amazon.com/ESPN pods to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, yeah, I'm not naive. I certainly appreciate as a player and on the player's side and a union leader, you appreciate more money in the game means more money for the players. Yeah. But as we talked about back in my day at business school, there's always trade-offs and you have to appreciate that there is going to be a cost for it and can't pretend that there won't be something else that you have to balance on the other end. So as we talked about the media rights deal, I think the next big, I guess, supply of revenue for the league that we're looking at in all the leagues in American leagues, especially basketball, because of how well positioned it is internationally. The next big tranche of money that everyone's going after is gambling money. We've seen recently that the NBA is planning new initiatives to allow fans to do in-game gambling. And this game is set up in such a way that I think it will be very profitable. That what are the fears that you guys have that you are trying to mitigate for as you dive headfirst, as all these leagues are, into sports gambling?
Yeah, the evolution of sports gambling here in the U.S. has been pretty rapid and quick, as you know, since the Supreme Court made their decision to open it up for states to legalize sports betting. That now close to 40 states, you know, 38 states in D.C. now have legalized sports betting. And so our view on that is that it goes back to providing customization for fans. There are fans that are betting and that want to bet on sports. We think it's obviously better that it is legalized, because before the changes in the sports betting laws and rules in the U.S., people were betting. They were just doing it underground. And I think there's no doubt that by having it be legalized now, there are things that we can do with our sports betting partners. We've invested significantly in our staff in terms of monitoring sports betting data, because the data is now more widely available. We've invested a ton in education of our players, of our staff, both at the team, at the league level, in the risk of betting, and we're investing significantly in promoting responsible gaming. So we think if fans bet responsibly and they do it in a very responsible way, it's an incredible engagement tool, because we know that people who actually bet on sports watch more games. They watch more minutes of games. They watch more ancillary content. And I think when you have fans that are more engaged in what they're watching and experiencing, that will drive the other parts of our business, the viewership, the social media engagement, the merchandise. And so for us, it really is about the fan engagement there.
You're also obviously opening yourself up to some level of risk. And we've seen the first, I guess, major gambling scandal in this new gambling age in sports. We've seen it start to open up with the Dodgers and Shohei Ohtani. What has the league done to prepare for what I believe to probably be inevitability of, we've already had in football a number of players suspended for gambling, not on their games in particular, but we know that at some point, and given basketball's history, it's going to be likely, in my view, that something is going to happen. How do you protect against the most important thing is that the integrity of the product? People won't watch the game if they believe that it's being influenced.
Oh, yeah, no. The integrity of the game is of the utmost importance. And so it's some of the things I talked about just now in terms of the investment in education. From the very first time NBA players come in, every one of our rookies goes through a rookie transition program. We educate them about the risk of sports betting. We actually do that on a regular basis with team meetings, with players, with team members as well. Again, the investment that we put in our staff in the league office about monitoring that data, we require our sports betting operators to actually provide us with information and put safety measures in place to ensure that we're tracking and monitoring the activity there. So those are the things that we're investing in to make sure that the integrity of the game is not compromised in any way.
How do you manage the officials when it comes to this?
Background checks, same education and training for them as well. So very much a rigorous process with those officials.
The officials' in-game metrics, I assume, are something else that you guys track to.
They are the most scrutinized group of employees in the world. I mean, every single game is analyzed. Every single game is taken a look at. And again, because the data is so widely available now, we can look at, are there movements and lines that seem unusual? And that kind of information wasn't available to us in the past.
What are you most excited about for the future of the NBA?
I'm most excited about the global opportunity that we have. You know, I spend a lot of my time around the world in terms of growing the game of basketball. And I mentioned there's a few places that have 1 billion people that love basketball in the world. And in China, we're the number one sport in basketball. Some 300 million people play the game of basketball in China. That's almost as much as the population of the United States. You know, in Africa, we just launched a league in Africa, the Basketball Africa League. I just say just, it's 4 years ago, but I was just in Pretoria, South Africa, 2 weeks ago, where we played for the first time Basketball Africa League games there and sold out crowds for BAL games. And it was incredible to see that enthusiasm for the game of basketball there. I will tell you, we have an academy there. You may have read about at least one kid, Kaman Maluach, South Sudanese kid. He's going to play. We found him at 14 years old at a camp. He was in our junior NBA program. We said, this kid's got talent. Put him in our academy. He's been in our academy now for 3-4 years. He's going to Duke next year, and he's going to play with Cooper Flagg, and he will likely be a top three, top five pick in the 2025 draft. 7'2", can shoot the ball, can dribble. I mean, just incredible. And there's another kid in our academy now, Ulrich Chamche, who will likely get drafted right out of the academy in Africa. So I'm just so excited about the opportunity to continue to grow the game of basketball amongst the 95% of the world that is outside the United States.
You mentioned the NCAA and Duke. I think, obviously, what's happening in NCAA has a great deal of impact. Like you mentioned, the players are what's core to this game, and there was a time when those players were household names in part because they came up through college basketball. We knew them, we valued them. I know that the NBA is folding G League Ignite, which was supposed to be one of the alternatives. How do you guys prepare for the new world of college basketball? And we're not quite sure what it's going to be, which it's a tough thing to deal with considering how important it is for the future of the NBA.
Yeah, well, that's a question, right? Because it is evolving. I think when we started Ignite, which was the first time that a basketball professional league, certainly us, created a pathway for a player coming out of high school that did not want to go to college It was a different time then. There was no NIL back then when we first started it. Well, since the advent of NIL, there's been overtime elite. You know, the NBL in Australia has been recruiting high school players that don't want to go to college. So there are all these different pathways now for a high school graduate to say, hey, I want to go play professional basketball. I don't want to go play in college. But now some players who say, I do want to go play in college, or otherwise may have done something differently, but now can actually make money
right
through their name, image, and likeness and playing in college. We think that's great. We think ultimately the best players in the world will end up playing in our league, no matter where they come from. And even last year's draft was very indicative of that. We had players from Ignite. We had players from Overtime Elite. We had international players. You know, I think the first American player coming out of college wasn't in the top five,
yep,
right? So I think there's, or maybe one of the top five. So I think there's all these different pathways of young players today who can make it into the NBA. And it's definitely still an evolving landscape. I mean, obviously, we're following closely with Dartmouth and the unionization of right the team there and the school's reaction to that. So I don't know where it's going to net out. I think optionality is good.
Yeah.
You know,
I obviously I don't disagree with that. And I'm a union guy and look forward to the day that comes when the college athletes are treated like the employees that I believe that they are. But I think I didn't ask this specifically, but as much as we appreciate and value the globalization of the sport, I think there's something to be said for known commodities and American-born players in the most important market having success. And the changing nature and the volatility of the pipeline, I think, has negatively impacted the potential of players coming through into your league. But like, we can be honest about how valuable it is to have someone that looks like and talks like and is familiar, like Larry Bird, one of the greatest players of all time. It helped that he was a white man from America, like as far as a marketing standpoint in coming up in America. And if we're in a position where the future of the league, there's really feels like there is, or the face of the league, it feels like Anthony Edwards might be it. But other than that, it's all international. And I think it's in part because of the crumbling pipeline.
Yeah. So there's a lot in there. I would say, one, we absolutely think that investing in youth basketball in America is a priority, and that's important. And we are doing a ton of work with that. We're working with our partners in the footwear category. We work very closely with the NCAA. So yes, we think that that's an important part of growing the pipeline here is to continue to invest in developing great basketball talent in the United States of America. And players like Anthony Edwards and Jason Tatum and Devin Booker, I mean, those guys are all potential faces of the NBA whenever LeBron decides to hang it up and Steph and those guys. So, I mean, the pipeline of great American players is still there. You know, the thing I think we could have a debate about is the importance of having American players to the success of the NBA. When you think about international soccer, it's the biggest sports business in the world, right? Is the global ecosystem of soccer. There aren't that many global, you know, American soccer players. So, you know, I think the NBA is a place where the best players in the world play. And the fact that you have Serbians and Slovenians and Canadians and Greeks and, you know, there will be and African players like Joel Embiid. I mean, we are a truly global league. We're the best players in the world. And remember, 95% of the world's population is yeah outside the United States. So I think, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo is as big of a superstar as anybody else in the world. And so I
obviously, you know, I agree wholeheartedly with you, but I think that we'd be lying to ourselves if we didn't think that the existence of Giannis impact the popularity of basketball in Greece a great deal. And the existence of, if the best player, if Kylian Mbappe was a kid from Atlanta, we would care a lot more about soccer than we do now. So like understanding that obviously it's helped you guys in a lot of different markets. We'd be naive to think that it doesn't matter that the top 10 players at some point in this near future might be all from outside the United States. And it's a result, in part a result of the way that we train and prepare our players.
I hear you. I mean, I think you could, I want to go see Victor Wembanyama play. I don't care if he's from Detroit or Paris. I want to see that guy play, right? And I think American fans can appreciate that and can appreciate greatness. But I hear your point. That's what I'm saying. We're not disregarding investing in American basketball. I think that is important. That's something that we're going to continue to do.
If Victor Wembanyama was from Baltimore, I'd be going out of my mind. But I went to see him at the Summer League, and yeah, he's getting better every day, and the rest of the league, they got 3 or 4 years left before. So he's an interesting name to bring up because I think a lot of us look back at the decision from LeBron James as like a pivotal moment for the players taking more control of their career. And I think that as we've talked about with all the things, there's a good and a bad side to that. And I think it was Ramona Shelburne who proposed a couple weeks ago that Victor may not want to stay in San Antonio because of the competitiveness of that organization right now. How do you guys address that going forward? Because I know Adam's spoken to this before, is that you guys do believe that it's a bit deleterious to the product that players are moving around from team to team.
Yeah, we have a CBA, as you know. You helped negotiate one of them. But we have a CBA, and the CBA governs the mobility of players. And there are some things that we put in this latest CBA that is going to give teams the opportunity to retain the players that they really want. And I think as long as teams and players are able to operate within that system, I think San Antonio in that particular case has to do everything they can, and they are, to make sure that they articulate a plan to Victor that says, here's our plan for getting us to that next level. We've seen examples of players staying in small markets like Giannis and being able to win a championship in Milwaukee. And again, we talked about Giannis, where Giannis doesn't have to be in New York to be a global superstar. You can do Shai Gilgeous-Alexander in Oklahoma City. He is a global superstar. He's in TV commercials. People are going to know who Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is. So because of the availability now on a global basis of our games, you don't have to be in a big market to get that kind of global exposure that our players are getting today.
Agreed. And I think that we all understand and appreciate that the stars are made in the postseason. And is there a fear? So I get that not wanting to allow players to move around. You want them to have roots and develop a personality and a connection with a city. However, there's the challenge of a team not building well around a potential star of the league. And is that something that concerns you also? If there's a great player that has an opportunity, but we never see them in the biggest moments, in part because the new rules instituted keep them in one city and that GM or owner has not built a winner around them.
Yeah, I think again, per our CBA, there are times in a player's contract where they're able to make that move if they don't feel like that's being addressed and happening. I will tell you for us, and you know this very well, because the goal of the CBA is to ensure competitive balance. We want every fan in here, no matter if you're a fan of San Antonio, the Lakers, Portland, or Brooklyn, to feel like going into it, my team has a chance to win. And I think that's what our CBA attempts to do, is to be able to disperse talent in a way that every team has a chance to win. And we've seen that in the last 10 years or so, there's been, something like 7 different champions in the last 10 years. And so I think, that's the kind of competitive balance that we're seeking. And the way you do that is through the collective bargaining agreement that allows certain flexibility for players. And again, players have the ability to move at certain times in their agreement. It's not like they can lock into, 9-10 year deals. That opportunity comes up every couple of years.
Okay, I'll end on this one. Are there things that obviously there are plenty of things that you have access to that we don't, given your position. Are there things within sports, the broader conversation, or within the NBA specifically, that we generally, like the students here and us in sports, should be aware of that we aren't?
The thing that I think a lot of people don't appreciate so much is how hard our players work. You know that because you worked at the Players Association, and they make it look so easy, but these guys put in their time into their craft to become great. And, they're the most, as I said earlier, they're the most talented athletes in the world, but they work hard at it. And I think that's one thing that we need to continue to do a job of educating our fans around the world to say, hey, these players care about their craft. They put in the work to become great. And I think that's one of the things that people might not really appreciate. But just seeing those guys every single day, and by the way, and the women as well, it's incredible what they do and how they approach their craft.
You really know how to butter up a moderator. I appreciate that. So anyway, you obviously work very hard too, and we thank you for that, and thank you for working hard up here on stage with me today. So appreciate it, Mark.
All right, huge thank you to Mark Tatum for doing that. Thank you to the student organization, Harvard Business School, the Business of Sports and Entertainment, for hosting us at that great event. And thanks to all the producers who worked on it, Charlie, Megan, Serafina, Brian, Kevin, in Podville. We out.
This is the Dominique Foxworth Show.